We started off with Frank Lloyd Wright's Prairie House, and also to your point about teaching the class, that even though I enjoy presenting the material, I think that I actually get more out of it than you guys do. And so I wanted to give an example of that from last week's lecture, how I picked something up here. So from this, if you remember the Prairie House in particular, so the Prairie House was a full-page ad that he took out in the Ladies' Home Journal in 1901. At the top of that ad, you can see this illustration, this one, the Prairie House here elongated, as well as his idea of putting four of them on a block and rotating them around to create a development. And then here's a plan of that block. And so if we zoom in a little closer, here you can see these four houses, they sit on the corners of the block. But what's interesting about it is in between the four houses, it's quite wooded, almost like a wild wilderness there, in contrast to the front of the house where it's clear, like clear lawn, the prairie, the open prairie. If we go look closer at this this illustration here, you can see as you look through the porte cochere in the distance is another structure with an arched opening, which is kind of significant because the front door in the house is really the only rounded arched opening to the house. And then if we look at the plan, you can see each one of these four houses are on the corner. But significantly, the houses are tied together with a wall. So all four houses are tied together, which is interesting. So they create this kind of like gated community that these four have access to the interior space, and the exterior space is more public. But significantly, as you come through this, look through the porte cochere here at the end, here's this arch structure, which is a detached, I'm guessing either a garage or a carriage house. But he banks the four of these up together tight in the center. What's interesting then is you go to the Wadsworth portfolio, 8 years later, he's in Italy redrafting all of his drawings to prepare them for this publication of this portfolio. And here we see the same illustration they used in the Ladies' Home Journal at the top of the page, and has the same four houses, the wooded center court in contrast to the exterior on the front. But then at the bottom of the portfolio page, he has these plans enlarged a little bit more so than in the journal, so you can see a little bit more of how he's laying these out. And he's showing two possible variations of how this could work. One is where he's taking the house and he's rotating it around as a pinwheel around the four. And this one here, he's mirroring the houses as opposed to rotating them around. But more significantly, you'll notice that the garage in the center is gone. So when he worked through this 8 years later, he not only removed the garage, but he actually labeled here these gardens. He realized that this initial thought of the wild openness was a significant thing to where he wanted to take the garage out. So running with that, I got to myself, wouldn't it be great to do a development today with a similar concept, four houses on a block, with a shared common space that's this kind of wilderness space that the four houses can kind of come together and meet serendipitously. And so this idea I took even further. Each one of these houses, I took one of his prairie houses and very quickly laid out a layout for the floor plan. But then I also put an open space in the center of the house itself, kind of like an interior courtyard. That would become kind of the heart of the home, that also keeps you connected to the exterior, to where the main spaces kind of open up onto this, as well as then the much like Wright, the houses kind of pinwheel around on the block. They're connected by this common wall so that you have this interior space, exterior space, kind of like this gated shared entry. But then at the same time, here's this this common wooded space in this point. And as you come out of the back of this house, you have your private backyard that's walled off. At the end here, there's an opening in the wall that brings you into this common space, and each one of these four kind of enter in from their own corner. So they kind of have an opportunity to run into your neighbor unexpectedly in these little private...
If you want to.
if you want to. Or if you, again, you have your backyard that's private, but you could also go into the space to even get away from your backyard if you wanted to escape your household. That's shown this idea to one of my colleagues. He said, okay, how do you take these four lots, these four houses on a block and replicate multiple blocks? How do you kind of encourage a similar interaction that you would get with these four houses at this common center space? So I took one of these blocks, put it adjacent to the other, separated them with a boulevard, which has kind of like a green median space, threw in that green space a bocce court with the idea thinking that the four neighbors that get to know each other pretty well by this shared common space come out of their block, and they meet up with the other block and they challenge them in a game of bocce. So then it creates kind of like this camaraderie within each one of these blocks against the others. Taking this even further, as you pair four of these together at the intersection or the center of the four lots, creating a well, which you find in kind of these older communities, ancient older communities, were usually centered by a water feature at the center of the community where they all shared this kind of common source for water. Again, much like the kind of modern day office cooler when you serendipitously meet someone up and you talk over ideas, a similar thing would happen. And this would enable the community as a larger whole of the four blocks to be able to interact, mingle. Same thing like this could open up for weekend markets, that type of thing.
In Italy, it was the oven.
Yeah, right.
Was
so all this was just a three-day kind of like little charrette that I went through from last week's. I was looking at Wright's illustration that I brought in from his portfolio, and before I kind of packed it away, I thought I'd take a little closer look at it. And notice that this little, through the garage, the arched opening. So, sorry for that, for those that came in late. I thought, since we will likely be running behind today, that we would jump to the end for, since we were...
Has anybody asked you to build something?
So I took it and I met up with, on Monday, met up with a couple builders that I'm working with on some houses and pitched the idea to them. They were pretty excited about it. We'll see if it goes anywhere.
Considering it uses lots of land, what do you think the minimum cost of such a house would be?
Well, that was the first question that came out of the builder's mouth.
Yeah.
And so with this, I also kind of worked through the numbers, anticipating that the lots themselves, each house is roughly about 100 by 150 foot lot, which is a moderate size lot, which is certainly doable. The block size is 250 by 250. A lot of it comes down to just the current market rate for labor and material these days, which is highly inflated from what it was just 2 years ago. So what's interesting is that in addition to this, I'm always trying to find ways to design and build things on a modest level, modest being, you know, just minimizing the room sizes down to their minimal, you know, essence, just to try to make it more affordable. And so that runs the gamut. One of the builders I presented to, their projects usually come in around $300, $350 a square foot. One of the other ones comes in usually around $125, $150 a square foot. So it's just kind of like a multiplication.
Would it be any economy of scale doing the four houses at
once? Exactly. So there is that economy of scale. And that's the concept, is that you could take four on a block and four blocks. You potentially could do 16, do a layout for a development of 16 houses, kind of like right out of the gate. And then with that being kind of phase one, that could go into like, you know, another 16 type thing if it's successful. So there's definitely that. So with that, ran a little bit long. We'll get into today, lecture on Zaha Hadid, the first of the five architects we're going to be looking at in today's in this course on the end of architecture. Zaha is great, which is why we're going to run hopefully not too long here today, because I've tried to pack in a lot of stuff
because there's just so much stuff and I left so much out. It's really difficult to get it into in an hour and a half. But Zaha is great because she, of the five architects we're going to be looking at in this series, she really kind of exemplifies more than the others this kind of arc from the beginning of her career to the end of her life, where she, you can see this progression that we talked about last week, where architecture is ending. And you can see this progression from the modernist tradition through at the beginning of her work and then through in to this progression of what we talked about last week, which is the elimination of the wall in particular, but also these other elements where we get these core elements of architecture that are fusing together and blurring together to where the distinctions are lost. And we're going to see a lot of that here today in this lecture. If you remember back, just to summarize real quickly, last week we were talking about Philip Johnson here in the center of the picture and Mies van der Rohe. They're two glass houses and comparing the two of them together. And both of them eliminating the wall, replacing it with glass. But in Phillips's case, he still was able to retain this sense of enclosure despite the fact that the wall went away. Real quick quote here from him where he said that you will notice that you can dominate the whole place from that room. And he's speaking of this room here, this carpeted living space here in his glass house, that you can sit on the center rug area, which is the aim of any house. When you enter a house, you metaphorically sniffing the way a dog finds his place to sit down is to go around and around until he finds the epicenter of comfort and then curls up. And you can do that without even knowing you're doing it when you enter a house. Where can I sit down? Where do I feel the center of things emotionally? And so here he's describing what we were describing last week, where he's really looking at it from a humanist perspective, this idea of the feel of a space, the sense of space. And for this was paramount to him in particular. I'll point out here for some of you might not notice, this is a 1964 meeting with on the occasion, I think, of his birthday. This is Andy Warhol, David Whitney, which was his partner, Dalton, and another architect here, Stern, on the right. Yes. So real quickly, before we get into Zaha, I wanted to also point out a significant thing from last week. This is the glass, Johnson's glass house on the left. Just 80 feet away is an identical proportioned brick house. Same length, same size as the glass house. And what's interesting about it is that he was using this, practically speaking, it was his guest house. So when he had guests over that didn't want to stay in a glass house, they could be completely enclosed in a brick house without windows. And but at the same time, he put the functional aspects of here, the heating system, that kind of thing, the mechanical systems, all were contained in here and then kind of piped underground to service the glass house, a question that came up last week. But more significantly, he designed this piece at the same time that he designed the glass house in tandem together, because in his mind, it was one composition. They weren't two separate structures. And so this idea that he had for a glass house necessitated this abstraction of taking the mass out of the glass house and displacing or removing it from the glass house. And by doing so, he leaves this void in the glass house by removing the physical mass or the density of the space and transplants it. And at the same time, even though he pulls the material out, he tries to preserve and hold on to the architectural aspect, which is more metaphysical, within the glass house. And by extension, because that architectural aspect is left in the glass house, he doesn't have any of that architectural aspect in this brick house. This is just strictly material, physical form. And so in his mind, he tried to make this void of any type of architectural concept, understanding, feeling. So it's an interesting play that he's doing there. So with that, we'll get into Zaha. This begins, we'll start with her graduate thesis when she studied at the Architectural Association in London. And this is her graduate thesis that we're looking at here. And we're seeing this fragmentation that she is taking, almost the way that the wall has dissolved prior to this. She's taking this destruction of the wall, almost like these shards and these pieces, and she's then playing with these broken pieces to create her architecture. At the association where she studied under one of her professors was Rem Koolhaas, a successful architect in his own right, and was quite an influence on her work, not only in school, but then also subsequently in her practice. But in that, in her graduate work, at the time, Koolhaas was very much into the Russian constructivist movement that we're seeing here, with the influence from many of the these pieces and parts, again, these fragments that are being pulled together. In this case, she's taking her thesis work was this structure that was spanning across the Thames River in London, and she's trying to take these pieces that she's showing here in these plans that she's created, as well as the axonometric drawing illustration, and she's showing how they kind of much the same way we saw just a minute ago with Wright's plans. Variations on the way these can be assembled and pieced together, almost like cubist pieces.
That was never built.
That's right. It was just a thesis project. This was in 1982. Oh, I'm sorry. 1976. Yes, thank you. 1976. I want to read a real quick quote here from Zaha related to these were paintings that she did rather than traditional drawings that were done by the architectural profession. She said that painting formed a critical part of my early career as the design tool that allowed us the intense experimentation in both form and movement leading to our radical approach to developing a new language for architecture. I felt limited by the poverty of the traditional system of drawing in architecture and was searching for new means of representation. I mean, everything was done through plan and section. So the painting really began because I thought the projections required a degree of distortion at the time. But eventually it affected the work, of course. The work became much more malleable because the origin of the work was also about layering, like an historical layering or archaeology. And so with this, like we saw in the previous image, she's taking these paintings and she's studying form and design three-dimensionally, much like you would today on the computer, but this was all pre-computer design. And so she's looking at it from not only a perspective, which is a very strange way to design. Most architects of her time, even today, still design in plan section elevation, which is a two-dimensional plane. She's looking at it three-dimensionally, but not only three-dimensionally, but also distorted three-dimensionally. So it's she's distorting these lines that normally would be straight, and they're becoming curvilinear. And this distortion is really where she's loosening up the material that she's working with. It's becoming more malleable in her own term. This plasticity that's coming along from the modern movement that Wright talked about over 100 years prior, where he's taken these modern materials that are much more plastic materials, and by the nature of the materials, it results in structures that have the possibility for more plasticity as well.
But could a builder build from looking at those plans?
Well, that's a skilled builder could.
Really?
So that's really kind of the question that comes to. In fact, you get a scenario where even the plans, to your point, are difficult to read. Even from a skilled architect might have difficulty reading the plans and figuring out what references what. As an example, this is one of her first projects that she took on, which was a design competition once she got out of school, set up her own practice. This was in 1982. This was a design for a leisure club outside of Hong Kong. And so we're seeing here in this illustration, down by the water, we're seeing the skyline of Hong Kong here.
up on the mountainside, the mountain that frames in the city, the very top, we see her her design for this leisure club, sitting at the top of the mountain. You can see here a night rendering comparing to a day rendering. And then you also see some additional sections that she's, close-ups here, where she's looking at the club itself. And so,
to that point of being able to differentiate the pieces without them labeled, without them identified, there's an abstraction that's going on, much like you would get in the 50s from these painters, the abstract expressionists, very much looks more like a painting than it does a piece of architecture. And that's really the point of it, is that she's much like a painter approaching it from that time period, trying to study form, design from that aspect and letting that come in and inform her work. More significantly, back to Frank Lloyd Wright from last week, he was looking at the Prairie House and this ground plane that was so significant that then Corbusier took and lifted his house up off the ground plane with these columns to double the ground plane. She's looking at the ground plane as well. Here's her, here's her leisure club up here. This is the side of the mountain that that it sits atop of, with down below here, Hong Kong itself. But she's taking the hillside that she's rendering here in a very specific way to show you that this is no longer a natural mountain form, but this is a man-made structure. And what she's proposing in her design is to take the entire mountain down to the bottom, remove it, excavate it, and then rebuild it back up. So that way the mountain itself, in addition to just the club that she's designing, becomes a man-made structure. And so by doing this, she's taking the landscape and she's claiming it. She's taking it as a built structure, no longer just a natural landscape like we have with Wright. And she's incorporating it into part of the design of just the structure itself. We can see here some further renderings here of the structure sitting on the hillside, tucked into it. The concept was these stacked linear long linear elements, slabs or planes. Again, very much in the same characteristic we looked at with the Prairie House from last week. And then also, very much like in her thesis, you can see off to the left here, she's got these slabs all kind of free floating in space. Here they assemble together to create the structure, and then another rendering of it over here. Here, when, as they're assembling, you can see the slab up top here, kind of an exploded perspective here where she's pulling them apart so you can see the interior spaces that are created, and then here they're all put together and set into the hillside. So she's kind of, within a single image, she's showing you the pieces and parts that go together in this process of how it's being assembled.
Was that ever built?
This, interestingly enough, she entered the competition and she won, which should have led to construction of the thing. But then after she won, and I think they saw how much they were getting into, it did not
materialize. So here's another illustration that she has showing a closer axonometric perspective of the space.
And significantly, I'll read another passage here from her where she's describing this. She says, the most radical decentering occurred with the upper pair of beams layers pulled apart vertically from the lower pair, creating a deep void.
So here she's taking these planes and she's separating them apart to create this voided space in between the two.
The usual hierarchies and orthogonal order of traditional building is missing. Elements float, pinned only by twisted, unstable diagonal lines and oblique planes, playing against each other, creating incomplete and distorted geometries. So within this void here,
voided space, she's creating the program of the actual leisure club, the swimming pool, the various elements that are going into this. And also significantly, this upper piece is being held up also by these inclined columns. So very much kind of in Corbusier's approach to raising the structure up off the ground. So here we can see another view of this where she's raising this up to create this voided space where the actual program of the building occurs. And we can see another illustration here of the swimming pool. that is occurring here down on the lower portion.
So it's this idea of creating this void, much like we saw with the glass house. In this case, actually becoming an exterior space that is truly voided. Here's a line drawing. Once she worked through this design and painting, she gets a little bit more concentrated as far as, to your point, how do you execute on building this? You need drawings that then have a little bit more detail, a little bit more precision. So she's working through the slope of the hillside, as well as the contours, as well as the structure itself, how this gets each layer gets piled on top of each other, working it through. And you can see kind of like the programming within these volumes.
See a project from every possible and impossible perspective.
That's right. Yeah, so much like the cubist, she's trying to see multiple views simultaneously, as well as also more than the cubist, trying to see views that maybe aren't possible to see in a three-dimensional form. And so she's trying to expose and clarify that. We'll see a little bit of that here in this next project of hers. This was in 1986. This was in Tokyo. This pavilion that she's creating, here she's studying it in model form, three-dimensional model form. And then also you can see these models that are becoming almost sectional, where much the way you would with the drawing, cutting through and being able to see the relationships of each of the spaces in some detail. But again, using the model as a tool to design from, as opposed to just a presentation model once the design is completed. These at the time, this was in late 80s, really became the models as well as the drawings that we're seeing here, the most popular form of rendering and designs for students at the time academically. It really set her on the map academically before she actually got anything built professionally. But we can see just the way that she represented the forms graphically here again in paintings, but then also drawings, line drawings. And then in particular, I'll point out on this one, she's taking the same way, layering these spaces. You can see the lower space, the middle space, and the upper space all kind of layered on top of each other with this line work that you can see through kind of the planes of the floor. So that way you can see the relationship of one, how one floor relates to the next. This is very much the way that you would do it on a computer today, but again, this was all kind of pre-computer design that was coming to architecture. And so she's seeing it kind of in the same way in her head, abstracting. And this enables her to be able to look through the structure as one whole complete piece, but also in this transparency, much the same way that the glass house was transparent. She's kind of applying that same kind of idea and thought to the way that she's looking at the building and also designing the building. I'll read another quote here. She said, "There is an issue we suffer from as architects. During the period when we all had no work in the 1970s, we were very productive with drawings. It was always criticized as paper architecture, as if we were trying to avoid engaging with the real world or didn't understand how to make buildings. But I'm convinced it was a very important period, a very critical time of investigation, and they helped us develop all the work that followed over the next 30 years. In this particular drawing, she comments, she says, the presentation began to inform the work and gives you ideas. These very difficult drawings were where we saw everything simultaneously in three dimensions at the same time, contouring the site in clear plexi. We began to see similarly between liquid space and rock. What does it mean to see a transparent way through the building? One of the realizations for us was that we did not have to have vertical circulation operate much like an extrusion or a vertical core, but rather the vertical path to shift from one level to the next. This was discovered because we had different plans overlaid with each other to construct a way to connect the levels in a new way. So when she started to overlay these plans of these shifting planes, and she realizes this circulation path, you're seeing the stairs here, didn't have to stack and go vertically like you do in most constructions, most buildings, for an efficiency purpose. But in her case, she realized there's an opportunity here to shift the stair around from floor to floor. And this was realized by seeing through each of these planes on the different levels. So in 1988, Philip Johnson mounted an exhibition of architectural work at MoMA in New York City that was titled The Deconstructivism in Architecture. And in this, he selected a handful of architects to showcase their work, much the same way he did with the modern period several decades prior. In that group, he highlighted Peter Eisenman, Frank Gehry, Rem Koolhaas, Daniel Libeskind, Tashumi, Koop Himblau, and then also Zaha Hadid. And Zaha was included despite the fact that she had no built work at this time. So interesting to point out that Philip, who was an astute observer of architecture, recognized not only her talent as an architect despite the fact she hadn't built, and felt that she needed to be included within this group of these other accomplished architects at the time. But more significantly, he realized that this was the direction that architecture was going, and she was the one that was taking it there.
How did she survive financially if she wasn't building anything?
That's a great question. So partly she worked as a teacher at her former school. She taught. And she spent most of her time entering all these competitions, much like the Hong Kong competition, figuring if she lands one that she could get her first project. Part of the hurdle that she was experiencing was the fact that she was a woman. And in a trade that was very male-dominated, there wasn't the belief, especially when you see some of these pictures that she was creating, that this kind of thing could get built.
And an Iraqi woman.
And an Iraqi woman, that's another good point. And so she was fighting this uphill battle to land her first project. And so that was definitely, without a question, a struggle. But despite that, Philip recognized, and also by putting her kind of in this class, in these exhibitions, it's putting her name out there, and these types of people that frequent this, that commission, are seen, are being told, you know, this is someone that needs to be hired. This brings us to her actual first built work. And this was in 1990. She started work on the Vitra fire station in Germany. And you can see again, here she is starting out with her paintings for the design of the piece. The actual site is right here. So this is the context that surrounds it. Much the same way that Wright was with the ground plan. All of this information that's going on around the site is also just as important as the site itself in her mind. It's what organizes and defines all these elements that she's playing with into the structure. So we see she's taking this context through these paintings. And as we get in a little bit closer to the site, you can see all of these lines and planes that are being compressed through this narrow, long site that she has to work with. And that's starting to organize how she's going to create this design. And then furthermore, all these planes, again, she's in this perspective that's distorted. It's creating a gesture or a movement or a feel to the structure. Despite the fact that these lines are straight, or planes are straight, just the way that it's rendered creates, again, this distortion that makes the form feel soft, plastic, amorphous. But more significantly, this being her first built work, I'll point out, here she's rendering in her illustrations these forms that feel distorted, like a forced, almost like a fisheye perspective. If you're familiar with fisheye lens and camera, where it kind of distorts the image visually, she's able to still render those distortions when she actually builds the form. And so it's not just a graphic thing that then once it's built out in three-dimensional form, that distortion is lost. This gesture and this distortion, she's able to retain and carry through to the final work so that it maintains this really dynamic sense of space that she's playing with in her paintings.
So where's the building? Where's the fire engine?
They're coming. So this is the fire station building here. This structure here is the fire station. I've got an image in here with the fire trucks, so you'll see them. Read another quote here. She says, "To establish the balance and poise of the massing, to refine the proportions, the flow and tension of the curves. All the elements you need, walls, columns, doors, windows." Again, these basic essential elements we talked about last week. These elements are like the brush strokes of a painting, establishing an overall legible composition. And so here we can see she's taking these columns that are angling and shifting, much like a brush stroke. And she's treating each one of these elements, the doors, the windows, the floors, the ceiling, the walls, as loose as you would a brush stroke, to where they can shift and they can distort freely. But nevertheless, despite that, we see here on the side a plan here with her rendering these various planes, and then her execution of it in a built form. You can see actually one of these classic right glass corner windows where she enables the space to kind of escape out the corner, the same type of effect that Wright was trying to achieve. But she's still able to, through this execution, you can see with the articulation of the wall, the roof, the floor, pull all these elements together in a very concrete way, because at the end of the day, a building still needs to practically function as a fire station. Also, this image here, you can see the continuous ribbon window from Corbusier last week, where the structure, because it's not a bearing wall, a discovery that Corbusier made, you can then have this free facade that enables a ribbon window to continue across there without any kind of structural implications. And then here we've got the fire trucks parked inside the fire station. One other thing, I'll read one last quote here from her on this project. She says, "An incredibly ambitious cantilevering front roof." This piece here, looking back also, if you remember Roby House last week, this long extending roof line. She's doing a similar thing. In Wright's case, he had this roof line that was rectilinear, but was still very dramatic in the way that it cantilevered out. And from the corner of the block, where you're taking on the one corner of that angle, it has a very dynamic kind of three-dimensional quality. She's taking it and she's bringing it to a point, so that way no matter where you're standing on the plan, you're still getting that same kind of dramatic concentration to a point that you would get in Wright's case with the Roby House, only if you're standing at the corner. But this long extending cantilever that's supported by these thin slender columns that are leaning and tilting almost as if they're going to fall down. An incredibly ambitious cantilevering front roof, which was intended to push too far and actually started to sag. It was overambitious. Even though the structural calculations were within the safety margins, which means that the roof had no risk of breaking, it was deforming. I realized at that point that the material reality is different from the calculations, especially if you're trying to do unusual things. And so here we see in her first built work, because this was the first time she'd taken all of her designs beyond the page, she's actually seeing how they actually perform. And she's starting to see that this long extended cantilever is sagging, much like Wright found out with falling water, for example. And so we have this realization that's coming to her that she's learning from her first built project. You know, that yes, she wants to push this envelope, but she also has to realize that it's not the same as what you're pushing it on a canvas or on a piece of paper. It has physical, real-world implications. She also went on to say that sketching is absolutely critical. I privileged the motion of the sketch hand as a literal option in my architecture. The dynamic fluidity of the sketches has become increasingly possible to manifest due to the advances in digital imaging software and construction techniques. And so here she's taking these initial sketches for designs, and she's trying to maintain that fluidity and that dynamic quality in the actual finish work itself. So in this case, she takes that and transposes it into her paintings, and then eventually tries to bring it through into the architecture itself. In this case, being the Rosenthal Center of Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, Ohio. This was in 1997 that she began work on this. It was completed in 2003. You can see one of the significant things with this center, she's playing with these volumes three-dimensionally. You can see that it also is a little bit more reserved than the firehouse. She kind of learned her lessons. But at the same time, she's still pushing the envelope. And in this case, the most significant thing in this development is this sidewalk plane down here continues from the exterior to the interior, again through the glass wall, the volume raised up off of the ground by the columns, all these elements that we're seeing from last week. This floor that continues inside, as it gets to the side property line here, it turns, rounds, and turns up the side of the wall and continues up as a wall surface. And so she's taken the floor plane and she's seamlessly rolled it up into the wall to where there's no distinction between where one starts and the other ends. So there's no place along here that you can say, okay, here, clearly this is a wall, this is a floor. She's trying to blur that transition. And this, again, is kind of her first pass at this. She's going to take this, as we're going to see here today, continue to push this on all aspects, where she's going to blur the lines between doors, windows, floors, walls, every aspect of architecture. With that, I think we'll take a quick 10-minute break here and pick it back up at 1:48.
Where did she work? In London?
Yes. She opened her own office when she left school, and then her office grew over time. It's now one of the leading practices, which actually in the second half we'll get into that a little bit more.
Structure. If you look on your slide pictures,
yeah,
you'll see that somehow she arranged the clouds in the sky to follow her themes. And it's not, no, the one before that.
Yeah.
That was right before these drawings. Now look at that sky.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Probably stood
the
out there all.
Yeah.
Yep. That is interesting.
If you get there first, start with that. The first structure is just a fire station.
Right.
And there's so much that is.
It wasn't one.
You know, I want to say not efficient.
Right.
So much
right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, from a budget perspective, you know, like she's spending all this time and money doing all these other things beyond just the fire, functional fire station.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also interesting that kind of first commission work was a small program. It was a small fire station.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a large one, but it was a small one. So the commission wasn't a whole lot of money that was being risked there, you know,
yeah,
this person. But also interesting was the Vitra Fire Station, which is, you know, this, we'll get into it next week with Frank Gehry. But the Vitra is this company that
designs and builds designer furniture. And so people, they recognize, you know, probably from this Joshua show, that, you know, this is an upper coming person in the design profession. And so because they were in design themselves, kind of cutting edge design, they were really trying to take that risk. But yeah, it's definitely a true point. It also makes you wonder, like, once that cantilever starts to sag, you know, as a building owner, you're thinking to yourself, what does this cantilever have to do with the fire trucks and the fire station? Like, to your point, you know, functionally, you know, is it really necessary to have this cantilever? You know, and so as it's starting to sag, the question is, do we spend the time and money to try to figure out how to stop the sagging and correct it? Or do we just let it sag, or do we remove it and take it away? You know, since it's not essential to the actual function, you know, the firehouse. And I suspect, you know, with it being vitro, that they realized that, you know, the design was significant. They, you know, they hired her for this reason, so they...
And to me, all of her things... suggests speed. Yeah.
Well, right.
You know, motion.
That's right.
And fire trucks.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Actually, there's a good quote related to that. I didn't read to that point, which is pretty good.
He was hell bent on buying a case of rolling rock to take home. It cost him a freaking fortune.
Yeah, I was thinking it's a big corporation that wants to make a statement, you know, it's one thing, but it's a
fire. Well, and you know, there are a lot of interesting in Jeffrey's course in Japanese architecture. Yeah. A lot of them were firehouses.
She said of the Vietra fire station, she said, representation of the movement frozen, alert. Almost as a structure ready to explode into action at any one moment, you know, much like a firehouse. And so this idea of trying to take this motion and this movement that you have with a fire truck when it's in action and kind of freeze it, you know, because architecture is kind of a static medium. And so it's this idea of trying to freeze this feeling of movement and without a doubt.
Getting back to that Philip Johnson guest house.
Right.
Weren't there windows on the other side of Facebook?
So he did. I cleverly didn't show you the backside. He did have three porthole windows on the backside, so that the design of the space was a guest bedroom as well as his library, like his collection of books, which he didn't have in the glass house, was in a reading room in the brick house, and so those two rooms did have. Porthole windows on the back.
I don't know what the numbers mean. I don't know what the
numbers mean. Is that centimeters? This was a long time.
Well, falling water, some of the cantilevers sagging, and they have to go in.
Yeah, falling water is an interesting story. I'm sure most of you have heard this one before, just living here in southwestern PA. But at the time that he was designing and building falling water, that the large cantilever that goes out across the creek, Kaufman was a little bit worried about it. He wasn't too sure, you know, if it was going to hold up. And so he hired a structural engineer to take a look at Wright's plans and designs to see and run the numbers to see if the cantilever that he was proposing was going to be structurally sound. And so when he came back, the engineer came back with an assessment, and he determined that there wasn't enough rebar in the concrete in order to support that cantilever. And so then Kaufman took that and presented it to Wright. And Wright, as you can imagine, his ego took offense to this, that he was even having his work checked, much less by a structural engineer. You know, he wasn't even an architect. And so he didn't understand, kind of like, much like Zaha,
didn't understand the importance of this design element, you know, taking this cantilever to an extreme. It was just strictly a structural thing for this engineer. And so Wright gave him the ultimatum. He says, look, he's like, you can either work with this engineer or you can work with me, but you can't work with both of us. And so then Kaufman rightly, you know, dismissed the engineer. But then from the story that's been told, Wright then went down to the job site when Kaufman didn't realize it, and he threw in some additional rebar to kind of hedge his bets.
And it still wasn't enough.
Right, exactly. And so it still continues to sag, and so it wasn't enough. And so then it had to be kind of, I think it's been 10, 15, 20 years now since they did some rework on it to structurally, and it's still sagging, and now they're raising money to kind of do some repair work again. So it's much like what Zaha found with her cantilever. Sometimes you can push it too far beyond what physically, because at the end of the day, you still have to deal with gravity, and gravity never loses.
You ought to talk about Frank Lloyd Wright's roofs.
Right.
There isn't one that doesn't leak.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in the modern period, and that's also another point, is that one of the characteristic elements of the modern architecture from mid-century was this flat roof. You know, the pitched roof went away by these modernists that were trying to reject history, and they were trying to reject all these things. But what they didn't realize, you know, much like, because they were young and inexperienced as well, is that there's a reason why the roof is pitched. You know, because when the water comes down and gravity again, you know, pulls it down the side. And so, you know, they end up with these flat roofs that tend to leak, you know, because the water doesn't drain away. It just puddles and it sits. And over time, you know, the material is again, it's going to lose to gravity because gravity always wins. And so
and water always wins.
And water, exactly. Yeah. Water is probably the most...
biggest enemy of a house.
Right. Not only a house, but just architecture in generally. I mean, for myself and most architects will tell you that, like, the one thing that you wrestle with more than anything is water. And there's in many different ways, not just with leaks. I mean, there's a lot of things that water involves. And it's a powerful force, and it doesn't give in. So we'll get back into this here. In 1995, Zaha's mentor, Rem Koolhaas, from school, published a book called Small, Medium, Large, Extra Large. And in that, he proposed this new idea of bigness, this idea that architecture has become supersized. To where it's now having an impact. I'll read a quick passage here. He says, beyond a certain scale, architecture acquires the properties of bigness. The size of a building alone embodies an ideological program independent of the will of its architects. Structures taller and deeper and bigger than ever before conceived, with a parallel potential for the reorganization of the social world. And so with this, he was trying to make the point that he was recognizing here in 1995 that architecture was growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, again, from these modern materials and methods that were affording buildings to be able to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And there was really no end in sight. They would continue to mushroom and continue to grow. And once they get to beyond a certain scale, humans that are occupying these buildings, we're not getting big right along with them. Our bodies are staying the same size proportionally. And so as the building grows in size, the human becomes diminished in relationship to it. Because traditionally, buildings are in relationship to the human body proportionally. And so there was this transitioning that was happening that Rem was very astute with, is that by this growing size in relationship to the human, that this human-centered architecture would evaporate away eventually as these buildings get too large. And so that's this precisely to the point of this course of where architecture is kind of dissolving. It's fading away, and this bigness was one aspect of that. And so here in 1998, just a couple years after this publication, we see a project here in Rome, Italy, by Zaha, where she's got this commission now, unlike what we saw in the first half of the lecture, where she's got a large scale project. She's been now kind of afforded a little bit more trust
to where she's been given a larger site as well as a larger budget. And so she's taking much what we saw in the first half, the site, these planes, distorting them along this linear length. But more significantly, to Rem's point on bigness, she's starting to see this large site, again, this bigness encompassing to where it's becoming, the program of the building itself is becoming part of the larger surrounding landscape.
Is she working on a computer now?
Not yet.
Not yet?
No. She's one of these that's resisting and rejecting and trying to... again, she doesn't want to abandon her roots of where she designs from, and she feels that the computer in this early stage is not really affording her any kind of advantages that she couldn't do on her own with the painting and the illustration.
What is that?
Let me get a couple images here. You can see the interior. It's a large civic community center. And again, you can see closer up, you can see also just the size of it proportionately to the figure here. You can see also her cantilevering that she's still bringing through. You can see the columns. All of these elements. Again, also the staircase, like we saw earlier, talking about not stacking the staircase like you would in a more efficient way in a building. It's becoming part of the expressive aspect of the structure itself.
Where is this again?
This is in Rome, Italy.
They don't take you to see that.
You can see, so here you can see a performance piece that's going on here at the time. You can see that... again, she's trying to blur this division as the wall kind of continuous form of space that we saw last week with Wright's concept where it continues on along this long ribbon that she's created across the site. This 2001, just a couple years later, Rem comes out with another essay that's entitled Junk Space. This was published by the Harvard School of Design, where he was teaching at the time. And in this is even more prophetic than the this idea of bigness, this concept of junk space. I'll read a passage here. He says, "Junk space is the residue mankind leaves on the planet. What coagulates while modernization is in progress. Junk space is the sum total of our current achievement. We have built more than did all previous generations put together. We do not leave pyramids. Architecture disappeared in the 20th century. The product of our encounter between escalator and air conditioning conceived in an incubator of sheetrock. How can architecture persist when the condition is the norm? When there is no form, only proliferation. And when space search for function like hermit crabs look for a vacant shell. Landscape has become junk space. Architecture is dead by this terminal hollowness. We have added nothing, just reconfigured. Color has disappeared to dampen the resulting cacophony. We're united in sedation. Why can't we tolerate stronger sensations, dissonance, awkwardness, genius, anarchy? Trees are tortured, lawns cover human manipulation so like thick pelts or even toupees. Entire mountains are dismembered to provide even greater quantities of authenticity." This is interesting, the passage he says that entire mountains are dismembered. There's a little reference here to Zaha's thesis, Hong Kong project. But here he's making this observation again. He's recognizing that not only are these buildings getting larger, but these modern materials, sheetrock and air conditioning, is affording this type of architecture that is built at such a great pace and speed that the time and the thought is not put into the work to create, like what we saw with last week, Philip Johnson's sense of space. This brings us to 2003, an opera house in China that we're seeing here, which is also kind of capitalizing on these ideas that that Rem, her mentor, is talking about. We can see here, interestingly enough, the way this is rendered, again, she's blurring the lines between the walls, the floors, the seating, but she's also rendering it in a mono material, again, to try to break this division between an element that would enable you to make this distinction.
And he's criticizing that. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, well, he's that's right. It's tongue in cheek, so it's not because he's out there building the same stuff himself. So you can see here the actual rendering of the theater inside. The blurring between the wall, the ceiling, these various layers that are carrying up through.
And I assume the material that was used was appropriate for an opera house acoustic.
That's right. She's got what she's also innovating, not only design and architecturally, she's also innovating in the materials as well. Much like we saw with Wright, was very fundamental in that, in kind of the innovation of the systems and the materials, using them in new applications. He really pushed the envelope in a lot of different ways. Zaha's doing the same thing. She developed what was called a molded glass fiber reinforced gypsum. In the trade, they refer to it as a GFRC, is kind of for shorthand, but it's taking this drywall gypsum that we're familiar with, and they're doing it in a molded form, much the same way you would do with a molded shrink form plastic or fiberglass. And so that enables her to get these forms and these curvatures that you can't render with a flat sheetrock drywall.
Do you happen to know what form the fiberglass is in when they use it?
What form it's in?
Yeah. Is it cloth or bits and pieces or strands or what?
I believe it's done in the shop. I'm not 100% certain on this, but I think that they, much the same process that you would do in smaller packaging, she's just kind of expanded it to the architectural world, to where each one of these panels that we see here, you can see it a little bit more. So in here, each one of these pieces would be kind of molded in shop to a particular specification.
But you don't know what form the fiberglass itself is in.
Well, I think in the shop before they manufacture it, I think it's in much the same way it's put on in layers, in the fibers that are layered up, and then it's formed together in a heating pressure process. I'll have to look into that and get back to you all next week.
Is it exterior as well?
It is exterior and interior both. She actually, we'll see in a project coming up here where she also develops another similar product for the exterior that holds up a little bit better than the interior work. Okay, interesting enough that you can see, this is actually a rendering. You can see the people down here in shadows. And then you can see the rendering versus the final form. Right. And also, of note to your question earlier, so by this point in time, the computer has kind of infiltrated the profession. And she is embracing that for a structure of this size. Each one of these pieces that has a curvature to it has to be kind of created individually on this computer, and then located and assembled on site. Is a very, as you can imagine, complex process in that the computer enables and affords in a much easier fashion than if you had to do all this kind of without a computer. And so we're seeing here kind of like this envelope that's being pushed even further because of the fact that there is this computer that she can take advantage of as a tool to do so. This was kind of brought to the front by Bill Bau, Gary's Guggenheim Museum that we'll see next week. But then kind of with the success of that, he demonstrated she realized, you know, I can't ignore this any longer. This brings us to a project called Ice Storm that was in Austria. This was an exhibition that she was given some space to kind of put on display a concept. And so she took this opportunity in this exhibition to really play with it and show what can be done with these kind of molded forms. And so you can see here in this image, you can see the scene here or here, these single pieces that are formed and shaped and then brought and assembled. And really kind of the limitation, you know, that you're dealing with in a single form is what's the size of the tool that you're using in a shop to create this form, you know, as far as what are those limitations you work with. So you can see each one of these pieces here with these forms are put together and assembled. But she takes, as you can see, very soft kind of like line curve that slowly transitions into a flat surface, transitions into this opening here, and she has some undulations across here that is also working its way. All of these things are rendered three-dimensionally on a computer very easily, much more easily than on a two-dimensional paper, the way that she did traditionally previously. But more significantly, that information that's on the computer that can then be transferred to a machine that's able then to create this object. And there's multiple different ways that this is being done today, different types of additive manufacturing, or in her case, she's still working with these kind of vacuum type forms in this modeled literally in this plastic material. And that's to the point is she's trying to create an architecture that has this plastic fluidity to it that is something that, you know, Wright talked about over 100 years ago, but she's taking it to the extreme.
So I must be missing something. So there are all these individual sections. How do they, are they glued together? What holds the whole thing together?
So underneath each one of these forms, there would be kind of an armature or a structure that's beneath it that then these things get attached to. We'll see a little bit in a subsequent project here. I'll go in a little bit more detail on that coming up here in a couple minutes. But there's these would be mechanically fastened together and attached to an armature that would kind of superstructure that would hold it in place.
And that's true of the buildings that she does as well.
That's right. And so this exhibition was a demonstration of the potential of these methods and these materials of what could be done on a larger scale with an entire building. She says the new design tools, digital design tools, allow us to integrate highly complex forms into a fluid and seamless whole. We like to work a lot with curvilinearity because we believe it visually simplifies the configuration, and you can then cope with more complexity without crowding or cluttering the visual scene. And so here she's, you can see, you know, real simple program. She's got a bench seat here that kind of wraps around, folds into kind of like an enclosed space, a desk space over here, counter space. She's just trying to demonstrate how these can all be assembled, but also, again, blurring the division between these various elements architecturally. Well, so these are functional. Like this bench is functional. This desk counter table here is functional as an element. So then she, from this exhibition, she gets a commission to do a hotel, design some suites inside a hotel in Spain, Madrid. Here we can see the lobby from off the elevator. So she's got some seating here to sit while you're waiting for the elevator to arrive. As you work your way from the lobby towards the room, she's working with some lighting here. Point out, as you step inside the room, you can see some seating, even something like a simple television set hanging on the wall that typically in most rooms would look pretty contemporary modern, almost looks antiquated compared to the space that she's in. You can see peeking back in through here, you can see
the bedroom beyond.
Here's a close-up where the bed, again, folds into the wall, into the ceiling. You know, the division between the wall and the ceiling is almost perceivable. Here's a
unit that for clothing, a closet space.
And then in the bathroom, the vanity and the shower. She also, here in 2006 in Germany, I'll show you a couple quick images here of this model that she's working with in model form with, again, she's applying the computer to the actual, to print or create these models to where she's able now, on a much more sophisticated level of detail, use the kind of like this ornamentation or this pattern on the surface to where it can become part of the articulation, also kind of blur the lines between the traditional roof and wall structure to where the form itself just becomes a three-dimensional form.
Excuse me, Matt, based on conversation real fast.
Yeah.
The last piece, the Silken Hotel Puerto America in Madrid, the continuous acrylic surface. So she was using acrylic surfaces and then she was also starting with the computerized milling machine, the CNCs that cut the molds used to thermoform that plastic surface elements there. So there was a question earlier I thought relevant.
Yeah, no, great. Appreciate you pointing that out. Right, so these CNC machines, much like she's using that same machine here to make her models in addition to just the actual finished product. She's realizing that there's an opportunity here to, again, use this technology to all of its limits. If you recall back first half of the lecture, her model that we saw very early on that was like this three-dimensional model, she's using it in a very similar way here to study the design, to study the sense of space that it creates down at the human scale. But because of the technology of printing these models, you're able to get much more tighter level of detail in the model than what we saw kind of in the first half, where the model was very much more crude. And so because of that, it makes it much easier as a client to be able to visually understand what this is going to be like once it's actually built and rendered three-dimensionally. There's not that kind of leap of faith that you have to take from a much more abstract model.
I was going to say, that's one of the unheralded positives of computer design, is that it makes it much easier to sell to a client, and much the client is not surprised by the product that they get.
That's right. I don't have it in this presentation here today, but there was actually a model that she was proposing to an Arab where they did a three-dimensional printed model in a metal because they have these machines that can print metal material. But then she selected gold as the metal material that was being used, so she printed this and the fact that this model was made in pure gold was, as you can imagine, is a selling point to a client, helps to kind of gain the commission. Here we can see the interior, kind of again, the rendering of this transparency. She's looking at these openings in this model, and much the same stuff that Meese and Johnson were exploring with their glass house, this transparency that allows light in, the amount of sight that goes beyond and through, she's looking at in this modulation here. This brings us probably to her most successful commission to date, which was in Baku. Again, another one of these kind of civic community centers. This was in 2007 that she began work on this. It was completed in 2012. And this, she's taking, again, these forms and the same type of approaches to what we've been seeing, but she's taking it even further at this point with this modeled structure. Again, to the question earlier, she's now taking this glass fiber reinforced where it was gypsum on the interior. She's now added concrete to the mix. And so for the exterior, she's able to have something a little bit more durable than the gypsum but still using the same kind of glass fiber reinforced process, this kind of vacuum sealing type method to render this. She then takes that step and goes even further again in this particular commission where she's using the glass fiber reinforced, but instead of concrete, she's using polyester, even a more plastic material than concrete. Mies, Corbusier, even Wright to some degree, were taking concrete, which was this new modern material that was plastic because it's liquid, and it has the ability to do more than just kind of like the straight planar materials. They recognized concrete could do much more. She's taking concrete in this plastic way, and she's actually working with plastics like these poly type materials, and through the methods that she's worked out in gypsum and concrete, she's now applying it here to this polyester. Again, much more durable on the exterior than a concrete, concrete being porous, than a polyester, which affords her the ability then to take that material from the ground plane, roll it up the side of the wall surface, and then up on top of the roof and across the roof. She's able, with a single material, she's able to use it in a roof application because it's durable from the perspective of water and gravity, but then able to roll that single material across the surface to where now the line is completely blurred between this transition that you normally would get in these forms, almost to the point where you feel like you could just walk right up on top of the building and across it as a landscape. And so much the same way that like Corbusier was taking his Villa Savoy and lifting it up off the ground with columns to create two landscapes, the ground plane and the roof garden, she's kind of doing a similar thing where she's taking the landscape and she's rolling it up onto her structure and extending the landscape across her structure. And if you recall back to her first project in Hong Kong, where she was proposing taking the mountain down and building it back up, so that way the landscape is this man-made structure, she's done the same thing here with the site. This is all a man-constructed structure here on the ground plane that then fuses up into the building and is able to blur that division by using the same material in both applications.
How is that supported? Are there columns or something?
Okay, that's a great segue. Give me two slides here.
Skateboarders love it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if this was in the United States, you would see these little like spikes along here.
They don't have skateboards in Europe?
I'm sure they're there, but they're a little bit more liberal, I guess, than we are. You can see here the ribbons that she's done in all of her projects. You can see just the ribbon really taken to its full extent here. And to where the folds in the ribbons create, you know, the openings in the walls. And so even the division between wall and window is becoming blurred to where there's not a distinct kind of separation to where those are happening. Similar way to the glass, the way that the walls are created with these panels, with the seams kind of pieced together. She's kind of pieced the glass itself as well together, accentuating those frames so that way it can be of the same vocabulary as the solid form.
I think in the previous slide, you saw that you saw a steel column.
Yeah, I've got a few images here coming up. Here's the interior. You can see even the lighting that she's incorporated into the design becoming linear and curved in the form of the shape, all playing towards the plasticity, bending the limit on what's traditionally understood, the division.
Like the TWA terminal on steroids.
Yes, that's right. They should have commissioned her for the renovation of the TWA.
Yeah.
Here's the theater you can see in comparison to the one in China. And then so finally here, the structure. So in this is kind of the way, and we'll get a little more detail next week with Gary, because he's really the one that kind of like cemented this with Bilbao, but you have this superstructure that we see here in blue.
this space frame truss system that's very strong and rigid, that it can be, because it's a truss system and it's replicated, it can create this kind of mesh or this surface that can kind of like span these incredible spans on its own without having kind of intermediate supports. That space frame kind of structure here in blue then gets a second structure in gray applied on top of it.
Much smaller, kind of a little bit more detailed, and then on top of that gray structure then gets applied these panels. So that's, it's kind of like a three-layered process that's being applied here. Oh, right.
Exactly. Here's some construction workers.
Yeah. Just to get a sense of scale.
So after it's built, do they have tunnels into the structure? Is that framework big enough that people can get inside and do maintenance? Or
Not typically, but like in certain areas that might be important, they will build in access. But not, generally speaking, not throughout the entire structure.
Doesn't look like it's big enough for a person to get in there.
That's right. And actually, you can see the blue superstructure has also got this larger kind of grid, a fourth structure that it's attached to and kind of playing off of. So this larger grid structure here is supporting that at these points where the grid attaches.
And that's permanent?
Yes. Each one of these pieces is a custom-made piece. Each one, you know, you can see just moving down along the line here, you can see each one is slightly different. And so each one of these has to be made, custom made, and then also then brought in and pieced together like a jigsaw puzzle. All of this, as you can imagine, is made much easier with a computer than doing this by hand.
What is that material?
Steel. So here you can see that the blue structure then is applied with this gray structure, which is a little bit smaller in scale so that it affords the attachment of each one of these panels to that. The gray structure is kind of laid out for the panel connection points that is overlaid on top of the blue. So it's this kind of three-part process that pieces it all together.
Do you know the same thing about that building that had the intricate design on the outside of it, the little metallic?
Well, that was a model.
That was a model, that's right.
Oh, that was just a model.
That's right.
That was never built.
It was built. I was showing you an example of this method, technique of this kind of additive construction or tooling, where she's even applying it to the models in her design work.
Human beings feel inside her spaces. That hotel room, I kept thinking, that would be a nightmare.
Right, yeah. It would. I think it definitely would be worthy of a study.
But who would want to undertake his study? Not the hotel.
Well, we used to live in caves, and we took what we got. Right?
But I'm sure they're paying more for that.
I was thinking, this will probably take. It looks like something a mole would hold around.
Yeah, so exactly, and actually that all of those points, it's a great commentary on the class itself as far as this end of architecture. You know, you're touching on exactly to this point that we had last week with Philip Johnson, is this sense of space. You know, at the end of the day, you still want to feel comfortable in this sense of space. And the fact that this material technology is kind of moving in this direction, that this bigness, this plasticity, all these things are kind of like not things that are inherent to kind of the human condition. And so as a result, you know, it's kind of leaving these human kind of confines in the past. And so we're ending up with an architecture that is kind of getting further separated from the human condition because it's embracing this technology and these materials. And so with that, this human sense of space is also being sacrificed or lost. This project here is in Beijing in 2015. It was completed in 2019. This was the last project that Zaha worked on before she passed away in 2016. the last project that she worked as far as design. Here you can see she's taken the poly material that we saw in the Baku center. Now she's replacing it with glass as her panels on the exterior. So here we're seeing really the full articulation of the glass house on one of these structures. And she's doing it in a similar way. Again, these panels that are in order to get the curvature of the form with a material that's a flat glass plane. She's segmenting these up into smaller panels, almost like fish scales, kind of layered together to create these this form.
What is this building?
This is it's an office building in Beijing. It's it's a mixed use. I believe it's got a hotel in there and a few other things. A mall, I believe. So this brings us to something that happened just recently here, April of this year. Her partner, Patrick Schumacher, who's been her partner with her office going all the way back to the beginning, the two of them, were a great fit because Zaha was this designer that created these amazing designs. He was more kind of like the mechanic that kind of like took it, the designs, and then carried it through into the construction side of it. So he was more kind of like this engineer mind where she was more of the artist. And this is something you find very frequently in a lot of offices where you get these partners that kind of each one has their own talent, and then together they can work together and create these amazing things. So here Schumacher finds himself in 2016, Zaha Hadid, the name of the office, has passed away. But despite that, they're still in high demand because they're one of the leading firms around the world creating this type of, pushing the envelope of architecture. And so he's still got commissions coming in, but he's lost his designer. He certainly wasn't the designer that was creating this stuff. And so just this past April, he came out in a symposium that he was speaking at, and he made this admission where he has started taking this AI software that I'm sure you've been reading and hearing about the last couple months, and where you can take text and convert it to images and type in a text prompt and create an image as a result of that. And so with this, some of the software that he's playing around with, he's able to type in a text prompt, for example, create a building in the style of Zaha Hadid. And more to the point, he's also able to take technology, takes a piece of paper and crumples it up into a form, and then he takes the computer and he scans that form, and then he also puts in the text prompt, and then the computer comes out with a design that looks like a Zaha Hadid building, in the shape and the form of the crumpled paper. So to the point where he says that, I'll read a passage here, what he said in April. He said, "Nearly all of them have Zaha Hadid in the prompting with various sorts of attributes and programmatic suggestions. I accept all of that into our overt. Any of what comes out of this, I claim authorship for in terms of validating, selecting, elaborating. So I feel very kind of empowered by all this possibility." If you can imagine, again, he's lost kind of like his partner that does this design work. Now he can still come up with a Zaha design exactly the way that she would have designed it, because this computer has got this entire inventory of all this design work that that she has created, and it's filtering it into this end product. He says, "For me, it's always been very similar to the verbal prompting that we did with the teams, referencing prior projects and ideas and gesturing with our hands." He says, "That way of generating ideas that we did in the past, I can now do directly with this AI software, that the team can do it as well on our behalf. And so I think it's quite potent." And so not only can he do Zaha, he can also take it and he can do Rem Koolhaas, or he could do Frank Gehry. And so, you know, here we have, more interestingly enough, is we have this technology that Zaha was embracing, Gehry, that we'll see next week. This technology is moving to the point where now it's able to create a design for a building, as well as these individuals that are held to the highest in the profession. But also, in addition to the design, the software is also able to build out and articulate the construction drawings that will build that building, as well as even then the software that we saw that she had championed, able to actually construct the materials and the elements that put it together, to the point where the technology is pushing the architects almost out of their own profession. This brings us to a project here called The Line. This is happening, started last year in construction, but this was a project that was started in 2016. So this was the year that she passed away was when this project was conceived of. This is in Saudi Arabia. They're creating a linear city across the desert. And this linear city is planned to be completed by 2030, is the concept. And they've employed multiple architects from around the world, the leading in the profession, Zaha being one of these, to work on this commission. And the idea is to take this line, the height of a skyscraper, and create this linear city with just a single circulation passage through the center of it, flanked on either side of the circulation line with this built form, this construction. And so on the interior, you get these habitable spaces, but on the exterior, you get this complete mirrored surface. So we have, much like the glass house, where we had the glass and the transparency, here they've rendered it in mirror, so that way it reflects the environment, and so it's where the structure almost kind of disappears visually, almost this camouflaged aberration.
And he'll put a golf course.
Here we can see the construction that began last October. You can see the size for scale here, some of these machines that are moving the earth or the desert around. And you can see the line kind of carved into the ground off into infinity here.
Do you know how long that is?
I do not have that off the top of my head here.
I'm just thinking of bringing water.
You've got a 170 kilometer long mega city.
Why? Is it stable? It's on sand.
Well, that's the engineering part.
Why? Oh, that's an odd question.
Because they can.
And
yeah.
It's very interesting.
And so here we see a rendering here, a last rendering, and someone mentioned about the golf courses. You can see up at the top plane, we pretty much have Corbusier's Villa Savoy here, kind of taken on into Rem Koolhaas's idea of bigness, to where you can see the glass structure here, the continuous ribbon window, and then on top of that, the roof garden that's continuous along the bottom plane here. The only thing they haven't done is lifted it up off the ground with pilotis, and that's actually to a significant point, because as you put in this 170 kilometer extended line, you create this wall. Again, this element that from day one in this class we've been trying to eliminate, and it's divided this desert from that desert for 170 kilometers, and so there's no passage from one to the other easily. I'm sure there'll be passages built in, but it's not something that the desert lizard can pass through easily. And so this Corbusier's concept of lifting it up off the ground plane to preserve that ground plane, I think might have been something that would have been kind of wise to put in. It might still fold it into the design here before it's completed. But we see a lot of these elements that they were wrestling with mid-century, Corbusier, Mies, Johnson, that are being articulated here today here in 2023, with this project to be completed in 2030. And so with that, we'll wrap up and pick up next week with Frank Gehry.